the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, where we discuss all things crypto related. Your host, Kieran Ryan.
A new book called Resistance Money takes a look at the philosophy behind Bitcoin. The name itself, Resistance Money, clues us into the revolutionary thesis behind Bitcoin as outlined by Satoshi Nakamoto in his famous white paper, and of course, why we should care about it. The book was written by Andrew Bailey, Bradley Rettler, and Craig Warnke, all of them academics who set out to explore the subject of money from a philosophical point of view. If one looks at countries like Zimbabwe and Venezuela, where inflation has wrecked the savings of millions of citizens, Bitcoin offers a lifeline to them and poses a threat to reckless government officials who have tilted a broken and corrupt system to benefit themselves. In this sense, Bitcoin may be the most revolutionary act in modern times, and not a drop of blood has been shed in the process. We're talking to co-author Bradley Rettler, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Wyoming in the United States. Bradley, thanks for joining us. Good to talk to you. Bitcoin has launched many dozens of books. Yours comes with very high praise indeed from the likes of MicroStrategy founder Michael Saylor and Alex Gladstein of the Human Rights Foundation. Explain what motivated you to write the book, and given the volume of literature already published on Bitcoin, where does yours fit in?
Well, first, thank you, Kieran. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on the podcast. I agree. There are absolutely tons of Bitcoin books, and Andrew and Craig and I like very many of them. Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money, is a fantastic book on the history of money and where things went wrong. The Little Bitcoin book is my favorite book, written by, I think, six human rights activists from five different countries. And covering the use cases for Bitcoin, I have five copies of that on my shelf. And when students want to know what Bitcoin is, I hand them a copy of that book because I just think it's a fantastic book. We saw a need to write an academic book on Bitcoin that really makes a case for Bitcoin using what we think are premises that nearly everyone in the world accepts. Premises having to do with privacy, censorship, financial inclusion, how the least well-off should be treated, and how our monetary policy should be governed. And so we use a philosophical thought experiment as the sort of backbone of the book, and it's John Harsanyi and John Rawls's Veil of Ignorance. And that invites us to think about if we didn't know who we were in the world, if we held fixed all the facts about the world, all the relations between people and all those natural facts, and we knew them all, we just didn't know which person in the world we were. When we stepped back into the world, having, you know, the ability to be any of those 8 billion people, would we want to step back into a world with Bitcoin or a world without Bitcoin? Harsanyi and Rawls used the thought experiment as a way of thinking about social structures and political systems. So if you didn't know who you'd be in the world, what kind of political system would you want? And we think it's a useful heuristic for thinking about all sorts of things, where you're not trying to figure out the ideal situation, what's the very best money in the world, but rather in a world like this, with all the problems that it has and all the good things that it has, is it better that Bitcoin exists in this world or not overall? And we think, given the number of people that are living under authoritarianism, that are living under patriarchies, that are living under rapid inflation, that are living with privacy encroachments and corporations who are trying to collect and sell their data, we think it's pretty clear that for the vast majority of people, Bitcoin helps them. And so if you could be any of them, you'd want to step back into the Bitcoin world rather than the non-Bitcoin world. And then we think, if that's the case, then when you step back into the world and you realize who you are, those people are still out there, even though they're not you. And so if you're at all a decent human being, you should care about those people, especially the people who may well die without the lifeline that Bitcoin offers. So that's kind of the backbone of the book, and I think lays out how it's different than the other books that are on offer. We're not monetary historians. We're not economists or computer scientists, right? Andreas Antonopoulos has written some great books about Bitcoin, that go into the various bits of code and things like that. And this book doesn't do that. It starts from the very beginning, explaining the cypherpunks and the history of privacy on the internet, and talks about digital cash and why it's necessary, and then how Bitcoin makes good on the promises of digital cash and where it falls a bit short and needs to be improved.
Right. And I guess I don't know if you would recommend these books in particular, but the Bitcoin Standard, of course, that's being quite widely promoted in the Bitcoin community by Saifedean Ammous. And then you have as well The Seventh Property by Eric Yakes. And a lot of people like those. Yours comes with a pretty interesting title, though, called Resistance Money. What's the resistance about?
It's about resisting the creeping authoritarianism that we see in the world around us. That comes from corporations and it comes from states. So we start the book with the cypherpunks. And the cypherpunks were a group that began in the 80s, 90s. And they were early internet pioneers. But while they saw the promises of the internet for things like democratizing information and giving that information to people in poor and rural areas, they also saw looming threats to privacy. And so the cypherpunks developed things like Tor, peer-to-peer file sharing, and things like that. And the holy grail for them was digital cash. So money that could be sent around on the internet peer-to-peer. And there were numerous attempts at this. David Chom's eCash was the first one that I know of, and then Adam Back's Hashcash, and a number of other attempts at this. But until Satoshi came up with proof of work and the blockchain, it just didn't work, and it certainly didn't work very widely. So the cypherpunks were trying to resist the overreach of governments and corporations when it comes to our data. And I think that's what Bitcoin allows us to do. Governments are threats to our privacy, right? They want to collect our financial data to be aware of what people are buying and selling. They're threats to our ability to transact at all. They put pressure on financial institutions to exclude certain people or certain transactions or certain types of transactions. They want to have authority over what kinds of things can be bought and sold. And they exert that authority with a threat of force to credit card processing companies and banks and things like that. And then, of course, there are threats to monetary policy. Governments exert a tremendous amount of control over the amount of money that there is and over who the money goes to at the beginning and how it gets distributed and how it gets redistributed. And Bitcoin enables people to resist all of those bits of government encroachment into privacy and censorship and monetary policy. And then corporations do similar things. They make money on our data. If they can use it to sell us things, they will. If they can't use it to sell us things, then they'll sell it to someone else who can. They also engage in their own sorts of censorship. Whether it's asked for by governments or not, PayPal is notorious for denying people access to their own PayPal accounts for whatever reasons PayPal wants at that time. And then there are threats to inclusion. So being able to buy and sell things today in contemporary society is necessary for human flourishing. And there are plenty of people who are denied access to the basic financial infrastructure that they need to be able to buy and sell things. They can't get bank accounts because they don't have the right kind of paperwork, or they live too far away, or they can't afford the kind of bank account that they need. A lot of banks, I don't know how it is over where you are, but a lot of banks in the United States require you to have a certain balance in order to have a free checking account. And if you fall below that balance, then you have to start paying a monthly maintenance fee. So you already don't have enough money, and then they're taking some of that money from you each month. And Bitcoin doesn't involve any of that. It's easy to get. There's nobody that can keep you from transacting. There are no authorities on the network. And the monetary policy is whether you like it or not, we think that it's far more important that Bitcoin's monetary policy is set in stone and predictable than what the particular monetary policy is. So Satoshi could have chosen sort of a, instead of a 21 million cap, he could have chosen emissions at the end for a certain amount of time. But the important thing is everyone knows exactly what the monetary policy is and what it's going to be for centuries to come.
Yeah, I'm going to come back to that in a minute, but I just want to talk about the rate of adoption of Bitcoin around the world and in Africa in particular. I mean, the early adopters of Bitcoin became very rich because they were buying Bitcoin at very low prices. And many later adopters were asset speculators. They saw an opportunity to profit from its volatility. When do you think we'll see Bitcoin become money that can be spent in the same way as we do US dollars or South African rands?
Money is a very interesting thing. Like language, it is a social kind. And what that means is that it depends for its existence on people, and not just individual people, like a sculpture might depend for its existence on a sculptor, but the cooperative activity of a large group of people. So money is what we decide that it is. It's what a sufficient number of people agree to use as money. And so the way to make Bitcoin a money that can be spent in that kind of way is for more people to do it and for them to draw in others to do it, maybe for there to be incentives for that to happen. I don't know what the conditions in each place around the world need to be in order for Bitcoin adoption to take off and be sufficient for Bitcoin to be money in that place. But I would suggest that it involves human activity and agreement and cooperation, certainly discussion and negotiation and encouragement, and things like meetups and Bitcoin education. And I think they're already happening, of course, and as they continue to happen more, I think we'll see Bitcoin take more and more of a role as the medium of exchange in these kinds of places. And I think that layer two solutions like the Lightning Network are helping accelerate that as they lower fees and merchants can see how much more of the money they get to keep rather than paying it out to some other company. And people get to see how much control they can have over their own money. And I hope to see that continue, especially in places like Zimbabwe that you mentioned earlier, where the local currency isn't necessarily trustworthy.
Yeah, I mean, and it is fairly easy in South Africa, certainly, for anybody to open up an account with an exchange where you can buy Bitcoin. It's pretty much the same as opening up a bank account. You've got to do your KYC. You've got to supply proof of address and a few other things, an ID document, and then you're good to go. And it can literally take a few hours to set that up. And let's just talk about Zimbabwe, because that's right on our doorstep here in South Africa, and they've had tremendous currency problems there going back for decades. The evidence is that Bitcoin adoption in Zimbabwe has been sluggish, but stablecoin adoption has been a lot stronger. People obviously want protection against weakening local currency. Now, the government in Zimbabwe recently introduced a gold-backed currency called the ZiG, which it hopes is going to solve the problem. The evidence so far is that doesn't really seem to be working. And it might be a tall ask for people in Zimbabwe to trust the ZiG, given the history of monetary abuse that they've had to suffer. They still prefer US dollars or US dollar-backed stable coins like Tether and USDC. But even these stable coins are generally used by the relatively affluent and not the ordinary people. So maybe you can outline, if you can, a future for Bitcoin as a form of universal money as it might apply to the people of Zimbabwe.
Sure. The one thing that is really difficult to use Bitcoin without is a smartphone. And while it's possible to use non-smartphones or even to have and hold and use Bitcoin without any sort of electronic device, to do it all on paper, it's really, really difficult. And so to the extent that people don't have smartphones, it's difficult to do that. Now, I don't know the rate of smartphone ownership in Zimbabwe. We did some research for the book at smartphone ownership in various places. And if I remember correctly, no country in the world had smartphone ownership of less than 90%, which we found incredibly high. We were worried that this was going to be a problem. And it turns out that people in most places have access to some kind of phone that has the capability of using Bitcoin. So it's not that people in Zimbabwe can't use Bitcoin. Then the next question is, well, what are they using instead? You said the relatively affluent people are using Tether and USDC. So there's some reason that they're not choosing to use Bitcoin. That might have to do with Bitcoin's volatility. It might have to do with the prevalence of the US dollar in physical form and just the ease of converting US dollars to stable coins and vice versa and prices and things like that. But of course, the people in Zimbabwe know best what they need. And so as long as Bitcoin education is happening and people are being made aware of the features of Bitcoin that others find valuable about it, it's, for example, lack of monetary rulers, it's censorship resistance. If they're still choosing to use stablecoins, then they must have a good reason. And maybe that is a reason that Bitcoin developers and layer two developers need to think about and make some changes. Or maybe it just has to do with the fact that the particular situation in Zimbabwe right now lends itself better to Tether and USDC. I don't know too much about the ZEC, but I do know a bit about the monetary history of Zimbabwe. And I wouldn't be surprised if people are skeptical about the government's claims about how much gold it has and are skeptical about the government's ability and commitment to keeping certain exchange rates. The ZIG was introduced at an exchange rate that was supposed to be roughly, I think, 14 ZIG to one US dollar, and it's already 18 to one. And so there's already some concerns that this is not a trustworthy store of value. And if you can't store your value in a currency for even a month without worrying that you're not going to be able to buy as much, then you're going to look elsewhere. And if the place that you're used to looking is US dollars, whether physical or something pegged to them in a sort of more trustworthy way, then I think it's no surprise that people in Zimbabwe are choosing to go in that direction instead.
One of the great promises of Bitcoin, of course, is that it would address the huge wealth inequality that we see around the world. No evidence yet that it's achieving anything like that. How do you see Bitcoin challenging the traditional economic paradigm, offering an alternative vision for a more equitable financial system around the world?
Yeah, so that's, I guess, two questions. How does Bitcoin challenge the traditional economic paradigm? And then how is Bitcoin contributing to a more equitable financial system? So to answer the first one, Bitcoin's challenging the traditional economic paradigm by being a monetary system that doesn't have trusted parties. Most monetary systems have trusted makers who you have to trust to create the currency and perhaps also destroy it, take it out of circulation. They have authorities who manage the money. These are usually banks, but in some cases, central banks. And then mediators, people who facilitate transactions between individuals and corporations or individuals and other individuals. And Bitcoin does away with all three of these roles. The maker is the system itself, and it's governed by rules, and those rules have not changed in the last decade and likely will not change. Bitcoin does away with managers because you manage your own money. And Bitcoin does away with mediators because it's peer-to-peer. One person transacts with another person. You can introduce mediators if you want to, but you don't need to. So in that way, It offers a different way of interacting with money and with the monetary system. Now, as to equitability, I agree that one of the very first articles I wrote, I did not get to title it, but I wrote an op-ed and the editors titled it, "Does Bitcoin Solve Wealth Inequality?" And I put that on the door of my office for people to read when they walked by. And I, a week later or so, I came into work and someone had just written a big no next to that question. And it's a fair point. Bitcoin has not solved wealth inequality. I don't think that Bitcoin has exacerbated wealth inequality. If you look at the supply equity ratio, which is the, if I remember correctly, the amount of Bitcoin that's held by the largest 1% of accounts. Bitcoin does better than any other cryptocurrency on this measure. And the same with the network distribution factor. So how much is owned by the bottom 10%? Bitcoin does a lot better on this than other cryptocurrencies. Now, it would be nice, what we wanted to do in the book was compare that to existing financial systems. But it turns out that it's much easier to audit the supply of Bitcoin than it is the supply of US dollars, especially when you consider treasuries and stock market and things like that. So it's really hard to figure out what the supply equity ratio and the network distribution factor for things like the US dollar are. But I think that we have a sense of wealth inequality when we look at the number of billionaires and how much wealth they have compared to the bottom. And I think it's something like the top 10 US wealthiest people have as much money as the bottom 50% of the entire population. So 10 people and 170 million people. So it's hard to do worse than that when it comes to Bitcoin. But as to whether Bitcoin is going to make that better or whether it's just going to usher in a similar system, there's two factors to consider. One is, can Bitcoin undo the wealth inequality that already exists? And that seems hard. Bitcoin isn't going to be able to take wealth away from the people who are already wealthy and redistribute it to the people who aren't. But the next question is, given the existence of Bitcoin, should we expect wealth inequality to go down given Bitcoin's features? And there, I'm slightly more optimistic, though not as optimistic as I once was, that the fact that a monetary system exists that doesn't reward insiders, that doesn't help the rich to get richer, as a part of the system. It's the way that money is distributed now is very much at the whims of people who are in charge, which are central banks and commercial banks. And they tend to give loans to people who are already wealthy, who they believe can pay them back. And as those loans get cheaper over time to pay back because of inflation, these people get more wealthy. Bitcoin doesn't have a system like that. And so it will not allow the wealthy to keep getting wealthier just as a matter of the system continuing to operate. In that way, it's much more like a proof of stake system where the validators who continue to get awarded new units of the currency are the ones who already have the most. So Bitcoin stands in contrast to systems like that. And I think that's some reason for some slight optimism. But it doesn't replace other things that people need to do in order to try to help the least well-off to have more.
Yeah, I think you're referring there to the Cantillon effect, where money is issued direct from Treasury through to the commercial banks, and these guys get first bite of any new money that's issued. Bitcoin doesn't do that at all. So you're probably going to see a lot more people having opportunities. It may not do away with wealth inequality, but there are going to be more people who will be able to insulate themselves against inflation. And this is the next point I wanted to bring up. And it's a point that was raised by Saifedean Amos in the Bitcoin Standard, is that when you're saving in fiat currency, you're driven into a system of financial speculation. You're buying stocks and you're buying bonds and you're placing it in the hands of asset managers who are taking bets on different assets. You could say the same about Bitcoin. That's certainly been extremely volatile. And of course, there's a big population out there that trades Bitcoin for that very reason. But, you know, do you see Bitcoin as is going to change the savings patterns and behaviors of people as we go forward in time?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. If you know that the money that you're holding is going to be less valuable in a month and even less valuable in a year and almost worthless in 100 years, then you have to do something else with it. You can't just stick it in the walls or stick it under the mattress and hold on to it. And there's no way of choosing something that doesn't involve any kind of risk at all. Even if you, I mean, I guess if you buy something like treasury bonds, that's about as risk-free as you can get, or at least it's about as risk-free as just holding on to the money. There's, of course, always a risk that the money is going to cease to be worth anything at all because the government that issued it ceases to exist or something. But you tend to look elsewhere. And in the U.S., at least, that's the stock market until very recently when especially young people started speculating on cryptocurrency. And this kind of relates to the last question that you had. So I talk to my students a lot about I say that I work on Bitcoin, and then they ask me about some other cryptocurrency like Doge or Shiba Inu or whatever. And I say, you know, I don't work on those. My interest is more on the side of human rights and people using Bitcoin to resist authoritarianism. And I don't give financial advice. But let's talk about this. Why do you have Doge? You're a 19-year-old kid. You have a minimum wage job or slightly above it. Why are you putting money into these things? And the response that I increasingly get from my students is, I don't believe that the American dream is possible for me anymore. I look at home ownership among millennials and it's declining. And by the time I'm old enough to buy a house, I'm going to be priced out of them. And I'm going to keep earning, but the value of houses is going to keep going up. And so I'm never going to be able to buy my own house. I'm never going to be able to have the life that my grandparents and great-grandparents had. My one shot is to invest in something that goes up 1,000 times. And so that's why I'm not going to do Bitcoin, because that's already happened with Bitcoin. I've got to find the next one. So cryptocurrencies are the vehicles of speculation for young people, at least who attend the University of Wyoming and who are interested in speculating. And I think that's a shame. It's partly the result of a complete lack of confidence that they'll be able to live a meaningful, productive life and be rewarded for doing so to the extent that they can be comfortable. These kids aren't trying to get like Elon Musk levels of rich. They're just trying to buy a house. And they think that the only way to do that is to buy Doge at the bottom and then sell it at the top. So that's really disappointing. Can Bitcoin be the solution to that? No. Definitely not. Because Bitcoin, there's not enough room for Bitcoin to go up that much without being more than the value of all the things that exist in the world right now. And also, that's not what Bitcoin is supposed to be. Bitcoin is supposed to be money, and it would be bad if money sort of was that volatile. Now, we had, of course, a discovery period where people were trying to decide how much Bitcoin was worth, and I don't think we're done with that period yet. But Bitcoin isn't hopefully going to be this massively speculative asset anymore. It's hopefully going to be more stable. And the long-term goal is for Bitcoin to serve as the a rules-based alternative to financial systems where the rules are known so far in advance and so many people know about them that there's not too much volatility anymore because there's not too much learning of new things about it. And of course, there's no unexpected fluctuations in supply.
All right. Final question, if I can ask you to give a fairly quick response to this one. I want to pick up the subject that you raise in the book about political oppression and how Bitcoin can overcome that. Can you give some real-world examples of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were first turned on to Bitcoin's work in human rights through the story of Roya Mahboob, who owned a tech company in Afghanistan and found out that her workers' wages were being confiscated by their husbands. And so she lowered their wages officially, and then started paying them part of their wages in Bitcoin, which they could have without their husbands knowing about it. And she found out some stories of abuse, and one woman was able to save enough of the Bitcoin that she could leave her husband. And that never would have happened if she was continuing to be paid the way that she was before. Days after the Russian attack on Ukraine, it was possible to send Bitcoin to people in Ukraine who could then immediately use it to buy food and buy blankets and things like that. And Bitcoin addresses were being published, I saw at least all over Twitter, of people who were living in Ukraine and who were promising to use the Bitcoin that was sent to them to help their neighbors. In Hong Kong, people were scared to buy protest equipment using any sort of digital money, but started using Bitcoin that they got from Bitcoin ATMs to buy train tickets to protests and to buy things like gas masks and cones. Nigeria, there was a special anti-riot squad, or the name was SARS, and people in Nigeria were protesting against SARS. One of the biggest groups leading these protest movements was the Nigerian Feminist Collective. And in an effort to try to quell these protests, the government blocked all the bank accounts of the Nigerian Feminist Collective. And so they started raising donations in Bitcoin and using those to continue the protests, which were largely successful. The SARS squads are pretty much gone from existence. So these are ways that people are using Bitcoin to protest authoritarian regimes. And there's also people who are using Bitcoin as just ways of opting out of their inflating or hyperinflating currencies. And so everywhere that you see the value of the local currency go down, you see searches for and acquisitions of Bitcoin go up. Most recently, Egypt, but Turkey, Argentina, etc. So there's the resisting of sort of political oppression on the one hand, and then there's the resisting of monetary oppression on the other hand. And I find it absolutely fascinating that Bitcoin can do both of these things for two, I think, very different reasons. One has to do with the privacy and censorship resistance, and the other has to do with the monetary policy of rules rather than rulers.
What a fascinating discussion. We're going to have to leave it there. Thanks very much, Bradley Rettler, Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Wyoming, for coming and speaking to us on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast, hosted by Kieran Ryan. To listen to our other podcasts, go to moneyweb.co.za or the MoneyWeb app and follow MoneyWeb News for daily updates.